Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama Wednesday will have more to say about the historic Iran nuclear deal when he holds a news conference at the White House to continue promoting the agreement. You can listen to the president's comments live on the air or on voanews.com beginning at 17 hours Universal Time. Many Republicans and some Democrats in Congress, as well as world leaders, disagree with President Obama's assessment of the deal that was reached by Iran and world powers Tuesday in Vienna. Meanwhile, the deal with Iran announced Tuesday might be a political win for President Obama, but it could be a major loss for Nigeria. VOA's Chris Stein reports.
The towers of banks and conglomerates punctuate the skyline of Nigeria's commercial hub, Lagos, but it's oil that keeps Africa's largest economy running. Sales of crude make up about 70% of government revenue. The nuclear deal between the Islamic Republic and a group of six nations would, among other things, ease the international economic sanctions imposed on the country. That would mean Iran would have greater access to markets for the 3.1 million barrels of crude oil it produces every day. A drop in oil prices could not come at a worse time for President Buhari. He campaigned on expensive promises like destroying the Boko Haram insurgent group, rebuilding Nigeria's war-torn northeast, and rehabilitating the country's derelict oil refineries. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
That's Greek lawmakers that we hear that are set to vote Wednesday on a tough new bailout legislation as the Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras presses lawmakers to support harsh reforms demanded by European creditors in exchange for badly needed cash. The bill specifies new taxes and pension reforms and tighter supervision of government finances. This is VOA News. Suspected Boko Haram militants have killed at least 45 people in northeastern Nigeria. It's the latest in a series of deadly attacks in the area. Witnesses say gunmen stormed the town of Minok on Monday evening and killed at least 30 people, in addition to burning down hundreds of homes. Abubakar Danmalan is part of a civilian group helping the army fight the militants. He said some of the victims were burnt beyond recognition. Late on Tuesday, gunmen attacked a village of Warsala that's on the border between Borno and Yobe states. A resident of the village says 15 people were killed there. A group of human rights organizations has urged U.S. President Barack Obama to use his upcoming trip to Kenya to press the government there to improve its human rights record. Human Rights Watch released a letter Wednesday on behalf of 17 rights organizations. The letter said those organizations are concerned that Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is undermining Kenya's constitution as well as its commitment to international human rights law under the pretext of promoting national security and combating terrorism. The leader of Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency has endorsed the group's political negotiations with the Kabul government and foreign countries to seek an end to the 14-year-old war. Ayaz Ghul reports from VOA South Asia Bureau in Islamabad.
Taliban chief Mullah Omar annually releases messages in connection with the Muslim Eid festival justifying the group's war in Afghanistan. But his statement Wednesday offered an unprecedented defense of the recent engagement with Afghan and foreign peace negotiators. The reclusive Taliban leader said the dialogue is a religiously legitimate strategy and is part of efforts aimed at driving foreign troops from Afghanistan. Therefore, Mullah Omar says the Taliban's political endeavors as well as its interactions with Afghans and foreign countries are aimed at bringing an end to the so-called occupation and to establish an independent Islamic system. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Ukrainian officials say 8 soldiers have been killed and 16 wounded from Tuesday morning to Wednesday morning. It's a sign of intensifying violence between government forces and pro-Russia rebels. 3 Ukrainian soldiers were killed by shelling, 5 others in a landmine explosion in the Luhansk area, according to the National Security and Defense Council. The death toll released Wednesday was the highest one-day toll in more than a month. China's economy grew at a slightly faster than expected pace in the latest quarter. That's according to official data released by Beijing Wednesday. The second quarter growth rate of 7% is equal to that of the previous quarter, but it's China's slowest quarterly rate since 2009. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency is warning refugees and migrants from the Horn of Africa not to make the perilous journey across the Red Sea to Yemen. The UNHCR says thousands of people continue to arrive in the country despite the dangers.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up. Also in the news, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni met today with rival factions in Burundi's political crisis. And a group of human rights organizations has urged U.S. President Barack Obama to use his upcoming trip to Kenya to press the government to improve its human rights record. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burkina Faso, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni met today with the rival factions in Burundi's political crisis. The Five Nation East African Community appointed Mr. Museveni as a mediator to try to settle the crisis that began in April. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. Opposition parties say that violates the constitution. More than 100 people have died in violence since then, and about 160,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries. Meanwhile, AFP reports Mr. Museveni was escorted by Ugandan armored vehicles when he arrived yesterday. He urged the Burundians to forget their past sectarian political differences and build their country on unity. Presidential elections in Burundi are scheduled for July 21st. Pro-government militiamen in southern Yemen have made major gains in the strategic southern port city of Aden in the past 24 hours, retaking the airport, the port region, and the diplomatic quarter from Houthi rebel fighters. The Saudi-led coalition is calling the battle to retake Aden Operation Golden Arrow and has given heavy weapons and armed vehicles to the pro-government militiamen. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Southern militiamen, supported by the Saudi-led coalition, traded fire with Houthi rebel fighters in several districts of the strategic port city of Aden. Witnesses say Houthi fighters have been driven out of key parts of the city, including the port, international airport, and a number of government buildings. A southern commander told Arab media the Houthis had been pushed back on two fronts in the north of Aden and to the east of the city. He indicated fighting was continuing in the southernmost crater district. Amateur video showed southern militiamen in control of Aden's international airport after they captured the facility Tuesday from the Houthis and forces loyal to former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Other video showed black smoke pouring from Aden's refinery after the Houthis allegedly fired on oil storage tanks, setting them ablaze. Residents of several southern Yemeni cities shot fireworks into the air overnight to celebrate the retreat of Houthi militiamen. Amateur video also showed some residents of Aden honking their car horns to rejoice. Elsewhere, the Houthis Al Masira TV claimed the Saudi-led coalition launched five airstrikes overnight on the international airport in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV claimed the Houthis, who control Sana'a, have put their forces in the city on alert. The Houthis were also reportedly pushed out of several districts in Yemen's third largest city of Taiz. Witnesses say Houthi forces shelled their opponents while Saudi coalition planes struck Houthi targets from the air. Houthi supporter claimed a Saudi airstrike inside the city killed a number of people in a jeep. Pro-Houthi media showed video of dead bodies lying next to a vehicle that appeared to have been struck by a missile. In the north of the country, Houthi forces claim to have fired rockets over the border into Saudi territory, striking targets in the city of Jazan. The Houthis Al Masira TV claimed several targets, including a cement factory and a bridge, were hit. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The UN Refugee Agency is warning refugees and migrants from the Horn of Africa not to make the perilous journey across the Red Sea to Yemen. The UNHCR says thousands of people continue to arrive in the country despite the dangers. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The latest United Nations figures put the number of civilians killed in Yemen since Saudi Arabia began its bombing campaign on March 26th at 1,670, with more than 3,800 wounded. Aid agencies report the escalation of the war has caused a sharp deterioration in the humanitarian situation, with 4 out of 5 Yemenis, or 21 out of 25 million people, now in need of assistance. Notwithstanding this dire situation, the UN Refugee Agency reports Somalis and Ethiopians continue to arrive in this war-torn country. Of the 37,000 who have come to Yemen this year, UNHCR representative in Yemen, Johannes van der Klauw, says 10,000 have arrived since the end of March.
People are either not informed, particularly the minors, or they take the deliberate choice to still come to a country in war because the economic migrants amongst them are on their way to Saudi Arabia, and is the only way to get there. But there are also still Somali coming, who still flee persecution in Somalia, and say we are safer in Yemen, notwithstanding the war, than we would be in staying back in Somalia.
Van der Klauw says many people may not be aware of the dangers they face in Yemen. Therefore, he says, the UNHCR and other agencies are running a mass information campaign in Somalia and Ethiopia to deter prospective migrants and refugees from coming. Yemen currently hosts 240,000 Somali refugees and 10,000 migrants from Ethiopia, Eritrea, Syria, and Iraq. Van der Klauw says 51,600 Yemenis, Somalis, Ethiopians, and nationals from other countries have fled Yemen over the past 3.5 months. He says most have gone to Djibouti, Somaliland, Puntland, and Somalia, some to Oman.
The Somali all self-evacuated. They at great risk to go to the ports of Mukalla, Hodeida, Mocha, even Aden when it was possible. They organize their own departure. It's difficult for them to organize their trip. There is, of course, money involved.
Van der Klauw says this is not a repatriation operation and the UNHCR is not facilitating these returns. However, he says the UNHCR and the International Organization for Migration are trying to help these desperate people better organize their departure. He says disabled people, widows with children and the elderly are particularly vulnerable and in need of protection. He says he worries about what awaits them when they arrive in Somalia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In related news, the World Health Organization says the humanitarian and health situation in Yemen continues to deteriorate. It warns it is especially critical in Aden and surrounding areas, with people lacking direct access to food, fuel, medical care, and safe drinking water. The WHO has delivered urgently needed health supplies. A 6-truck convoy has arrived in Aden with over 46 tons of aid, including medicines, trauma care supplies, and kits to treat diarrhea. The WHO is also conducting rapid tests for dengue fever and malaria. Also, more than 9,000 bed nets have been distributed, along with residual spraying materials and equipment. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni met today with rival factions in Burundi's political crisis. And the UN Refugee Agency is warning refugees and migrants from the Horn of Africa not to make the perilous journey across the Red Sea to Yemen. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The Westgate Mall in Kenya's capital will reopen on Saturday. The move comes 2 years after Al-Shabaab gunmen shot and killed 67 shoppers in a four-day shootout with police. The Israeli company responsible for security in the trendy Nairobi shopping center promises the renovated Westgate shopping center will be the safest in the world. Improved security includes explosive detectors, luggage x-rays, scanners to check underneath cars, bollards to prevent car bombs, and bulletproof guard towers. Al-Shabaab has killed more than 400 people in Kenya over the last 2 years, including 148 in a rampage at Garissa University College in eastern Kenya in April. Britain and other Western powers have issued several travel advisories warning of more attacks. Meanwhile, a group of human rights organizations has urged U.S. President Barack Obama to use his upcoming trip to Kenya to press the government to improve its human rights record. Human Rights Watch released a letter today on behalf of 17 rights organizations. The letter said the organizations are concerned that Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is undermining Kenya's constitution and its commitment to international human rights law under the pretext of promoting national security and combating terrorism. The letter says President Obama has a unique opportunity to urge President Kenyatta to stick to the 2010 Constitution, as the United States is one of Kenya's closest allies in the fight against terrorism. The letter said, "We urge you to raise this critical issue during your upcoming historic visit to Kenya." Mr. Obama is scheduled to visit Kenya later this month in his first visit as U.S. president to his father's homeland. The U.S. State Department has issued a travel warning to U.S. citizens traveling to Kenya ahead of Mr. Obama's appearance at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, July 24th through 26th in Nairobi. The summit is expected to draw 1,500 attendees from around the world. And the U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists has released a report on what it calls the deteriorating climate for press freedom in Kenya. The media advocacy group says Kenyan journalists face repressive legislation and increasing physical threats. Hilary Hewler has more from Nairobi.
The report, released Wednesday, paints a bleak picture of Kenya's media, long considered the most robust in East Africa. It documents cases of journalists being beaten, arrested, and intimidated for their work, especially outside the capital, Nairobi. CPJ's Tom Rhodes says that since Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta came to power 2 years ago, journalism has become a more dangerous profession.
I've counted since the beginning of this year and documented 19 cases from January to May 2015 of attacks, threats, imprisonments, and harassments of the Kenyan press, which basically works out to be one case per week. And in all 4 years that I've been here in Kenya, I've never seen such high levels before.
What makes this trend more worrisome, he adds, is that this intimidation takes place with almost complete impunity.
What has happened in all of these cases? To date, nothing. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why we're seeing this increase in cases. It's simply because it can happen. It's allowed to happen.
Rhodes says most of the cases documented this year have involved Kenyan officials or police and tend to revolve around topics like land disputes, corruption, security, and the International Criminal Court. The result, says Rhodes, is that certain topics have become no-go areas for the Kenyan press. Government officials say journalists aren't in any danger, but Kenya has passed a series of recent laws impacting press freedom, many of which have been challenged and are tied up in court. These include a law limiting the media's right to report on security issues, and another forbidding journalists from handling classified information. Official harassment doesn't stop at the formal media, the CPJ report adds. It says the government has been cracking down on social media as well, and a number of people have been arrested for blogging about certain subjects or for posting on the social media site Facebook. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
World leaders are in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, for the third International Conference on Financing for Development. They are addressing the challenge of how to pay for the elimination of world hunger and poverty. A lead player in the discussions is the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD. It says the people most affected by poverty, rural smallholder farmers, should be a big part of the solution. IFAD President Kanye Nwanze says it's not just about money. He says given the right support, rural people can transform their own communities themselves. He spoke to my colleague Kim Lewis about what world leaders should be focusing on to eliminate poverty and finance future development.
I would say for all of them, they need to invest in development. And development for us at IFAD is development of rural areas. And that's where there is a disparity, that's where there is a disconnection between the rich and the poor, between the urban and the rural areas. There has to be increased investment in people in rural areas, not just development as an abstract occupation. It's people that have to move out of poverty. Essentially, we're looking at the majority of the poor people living in developing countries, in rural areas of developing countries, about 70%. So it has to be investment not only in their primary source of livelihood, which is agriculture, smallholder agriculture, but also on infrastructure, services, you know, and access to financial services, education and what have you. So it's basically a development process that involves people and what people do for their living.
How then can rural families improve their lives without relying on international aid?
Have you seen any country that developed because of international aid? Do you know one country in the world that was able to escape out of poverty through international development or through the investment of its own people, of its own government and its own people? This, for me, is very critical. We have to change our mindset and think that international aid is going to develop a people. People develop themselves through their own, first and foremost, internal processes. International aid is supposed to support that effort. So my call, first and foremost, is that leaders of developing countries must invest in their own people, no matter how little they have. Then international aid will support that effort. It's only then you can have long-term sustainable development.
With the majority of the rural families, farming is their source of livelihoods. So how will they obtain access to new technologies to help improve their farming?
First, it's investment in education. People have to be educated to know how to use technology. Two, investment in agriculture. Investment in agricultural research that generates those technologies. Educating people on the benefits of investing in their own businesses. I mean, if you want to increase production and productivity, you have to use modern technologies that already exist. So they have to have access to those technologies. Agricultural schools have to be properly equipped. And so it's an investment in overall infrastructure. So essentially what we're saying here, for people to be able to access those technologies, we have to have the macroeconomic policies that make it possible for people to have access to those technologies, and they are available. You have to have extension services to help the farmers to know how to use these technologies. We're not reinventing the wheel here. So essentially, I go back to the same call. If you want to use technologies that are adapted to your own agricultural systems, you have to have institutions that can draw from the storehouse of knowledge that exists in the global space to be able to adapt those technologies to their own environments. I think that's the starting point for me.
Also, in looking ahead, by the year 2050, you all estimate that 9.6 billion people will be living in this world. So how will these people obtain their food supply? How do you see it?
If we continue to development as an abstract aspect of life and not focus on the people themselves, I'm not so sure we're going to be able to feed 9.6 billion people. As I said again, where is hunger and poverty? It exists in rural areas of developing countries. What is the main source of livelihoods of these people so that produce about 80% of the food that is consumed in developing countries? It is agriculture, smallholder agriculture. So if we want to invest in agriculture to become productive, we must invest in the people that are engaged in agriculture as a business, and the business has to make profits. So basically what we are saying here again, investing in rural people is the first step towards achieving food security, because their business is agriculture, producing food. And when we do that, we must also make sure that the infrastructure is there, the roads, the electricity, irrigation services, access to inputs, financial services, social services, schools, clinics, and what have you for these rural areas. We are not going to be able to achieve our goal of feeding the world come 2050 if we still have the rural space lagging behind in their ability to produce more food and to produce it better.
That was Kanye Nwanze, president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD. He spoke to my colleague Kim Lewis from Addis Ababa. The nuclear deal with Iran announced yesterday might be a political win for U.S. President Barack Obama, but it could be a major loss for oil-producing Nigeria. VOA's Chris Stein tells you why.
The towers of banks and conglomerates punctuate the skyline of Nigeria's commercial hub, Lagos. But make no mistake, it's oil that keeps Africa's largest economy running. Sales of crude make up about 70% of government revenue. Last year's global drop in the price of oil delivered a blow to Nigeria's economy. Soon after taking office, President Muhammadu Buhari described the treasury as virtually empty. Now, analysts say there's a new threat to Nigeria's economy, Iran. The nuclear deal between the Islamic Republic and a group of six nations would, among other things, ease the international economic sanctions imposed on the country. That would mean Iran would have greater access to markets for the 3.1 million barrels of crude oil it produces every day. That jump in supply could see Nigeria's revenues dwindle as the price of crude drops, says the CEO of Lagos-based financial derivatives company Limited, Bismarck Rawani.
It is, to a large extent, depending on how low the price goes, it is a game changer.
A drop in oil prices could not come at a worse time for President Buhari. He campaigned on expensive promises like destroying the Boko Haram insurgent group, rebuilding Nigeria's war-torn northeast, and rehabilitating the country's derelict oil refineries, which process only a fraction of the crude Nigeria produces. But with money tight and expected to get tighter, Mr. Rawani says the administration will have to borrow and spend wisely.
So there'll be two approaches. One is being more prudent in what you have, and secondly, borrowing to spend on impactful investments in the infrastructure space.
Numerous hurdles remain to the Iran deal's implementation, perhaps none greater than the approval by the U.S. Congress. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
If you come into contact with the bodily fluids of a person infected with Ebola, you must wash with soap and water immediately. I'm Dr. Kande Greaves. The Ebola virus is only present in the blood, feces, vomit, breast milk, sweat, and semen of people who are seriously ill. The virus must get into your body to infect you. Do not touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, and cover any cuts on the skin. If you are caring for someone who has Ebola, do not handle bedding, towels, or clothes that may be soiled with bodily fluids without gloves. Avoid sexual activity with male survivors of Ebola. Men carry the virus in semen for up to 90 days. Ebola cannot survive for long outside the body. Sunlight, heat, Clorox, and alcohol will kill the virus. Know the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni met today with rival factions in Burundi's political crisis. The UN Refugee Agency is warning refugees and migrants from the Horn of Africa not to make the perilous journey across the Red Sea to Yemen. And a group of human rights organizations has urged U.S. President Barack Obama to use his upcoming trip to Kenya to press the government to improve its human rights record. Coming up, music from Burkina Faso. And in our feature segment, experts say global joblessness will only get worse over the next 5 years. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand you're beginning this evening in Nigeria's political capital.
Yehiz, let's kick off in Abuja, where the Nigeria Football Federation on Wednesday formally introduced former national team captain Sunday Olise as the new head coach of the Super Eagles, the country's national team. The 40-year-old Olise replaces another former Super Eagles player, Stephen Keshi, who was fired earlier this month. NFF President Amaju Pinnick introduced Olise at the Abuja news conference.
Well, today is another epoch-making day in the history or historiographic literature of football of Nigeria. We are very, very excited about today. Today, we have just been able to unveil present the Pep Guardiola of Africa.
Nigeria Football Federation President Amaju Pinnick says Sunday Olise has the qualities to take Nigeria football to great heights. And if Olise wasn't feeling any pressure before that Abuja news conference, I imagine being described as the Pep Guardiola of Africa does turn up those pressure valves just a bit. Olise says it's a great honor to be Nigeria's coach, but he cautions those who may be expecting him to perform a miracle of sorts.
First of all, I'm not coming as a messiah. I'm not coming as a man who knows it all. I'm not coming as someone who can singularly, alone, just turn Nigeria into Germany. But I'm coming as a man who has come to serve his country and ready to give 150%.
Sunday Olise's immediate challenge is to qualify Nigeria for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament, which will be hosted by Gabon. Nigeria, a three-time Nations Cup champion, kicked off its 2017 qualifying campaign with a 2-0 victory over visiting Chad last month in Kaduna. Reaction to Olise's appointment seems generally favorable. I asked for comments at my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. Abdul Daniel Dio, who is from Anambra State, Nigeria, says he supports Olise 150%. Jimmy Isaiah Dexter, writing from Lagos, Nigeria, says he wishes Olise all the best. And Jimmy adds, Olise should select players on merit and present form and not by compulsion. And Samuel Atilola, also writing from Lagos, says, all eyes are on Olise. He should be responsible for his decisions. I believe he'll deliver. Joining us once again on the Sunny Side of Sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Sporty greetings, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, let's kick off with African club football. Recent action in both the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup tournaments. Let's begin with the Champions League, David, and how about the results?
Right, Sonny, we look at Group A first. It was Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco, 0. TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo, 0. And Al Hilal of Sudan, 2. Smouha of Egypt, 0. Real turn up in this group, Sonny. It was expected to be dominated by Mazembe, but as things stand after two rounds, Mazembe are only third. The standings are Hilal on top with 4 points, Smuha have 3, Mazembe have 2, and Tetouan have got 1 point. If we look at the matches, Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco, they were on top in the first half against Mazembe and had several chances to go ahead, while Mazembe were better in the second half and came close to scoring. But a big worry, Sonny, for this Mazembe team, which, remember, is a mix of players from Congo, Ghana, Mali, Tanzania and Zambia. It's a real multinational outfit. Is they've now gone 2 matches. The good news is they haven't conceded any goals. But the really bad and worrying news for their French coach, Patrice Carteron, they haven't scored a single goal. 2 draws, no goals scored, no goals conceded, and that's got to be a worry. And they're away again in the next round of matches. They're playing Smuha, the Egyptian side, in Alexandria. On the other hand, the surprise packet so far, the Sudanese club Al-Hilal. Al-Hilal have been runners-up twice when the competition was known as the African Champions Cup. And more recently, they've reached the semi-finals 3 times, but they haven't been able to make that breakthrough. Now, on a previous Sunnyside Sport, I mentioned how impressive they were against Mazembe in Lubumbashi. In fact, unlucky not to win that game. And they kept up that good form at home against Smuha. No goals in the first half, but 7 minutes after half-time, Ahmed put them in front. And then Hamid, with a brilliant solo goal, dribbling past several defenders before scoring. He made it 2-0 with 9 minutes to go, and that was that. So, at the moment, the significant issues from Group A are the good form of Hilal and the fact that Mazembe are struggling and not scoring any goals. In the next round of fixtures, which come up on July the 26th, Smuha are at home to Mazembe, and Tetouan host Hilal. Moving on, Sonny, to Group B, Mouloudia El Ulma of Algeria 0, Entente Setif of Algeria, the title holders, 1, and Usma of Algiers 1, Al-Marek of Sudan 0. So 2 very tight affairs, these, both decided by a lone goal. And in the case of Setif, it was into stoppage time before Bellamiri scored the only goal, and that put Setif back on track after they had lost their opening match at home to Usma Alger. Usma Alger, on the other hand, they're the pace setters, a lone goal 8 minutes after half-time from Bel Alia. That gave them a 1-0 victory over Marek. I did see some footage of this game, Sonny, and a very controversially disallowed goal for the Sudanese, 3 minutes from time. A corner kick came across, and it was powerfully headed into the net. And the assistant referee, he said that the ball had gone out of play from the corner and then came back in before it was headed into the net. Now, unfortunately, the angle that I saw, Sonny, meant it was indecisive whether that actually happened or not. But that would be rather odd that you take a corner kick, it goes out of play, and then goes back into play before a goal is scored. As a result of those games, Sonny, the standings are Usma on top with 6 points. Marek and Setif have got 3 points each. At the moment, Marek from Sudan, they've got a slight edge because they've got a +1 goal difference. Setif, on the other hand, are level. They've scored 2 and conceded 2. And Ulma, I'm afraid, after just 2 rounds, are in big trouble. They've got no points at all. And in the next round of matches, on July the 24th, USM will play Ulma. So that's a top versus bottom clash. And a day later, on July the 25th, I think a very significant game, Setif and Marek. My gut feel at this stage, Sonny, is that Usma are going to win this group. And I see it as a battle between Setif and Marek to finish second and also qualify for the semi-finals. And in consecutive rounds, we're going to have Setif at home to Marek and then Marek at home to Setif. And I think if either of those clubs can get 4 points, in other words, win at home and draw away, I think that is the club that will make it through to the semi-finals. Voice of America! A reminder to all Voice of America listeners, the group winners and the group runners-up, after a 6-match-day series of games, they qualify for the semifinals.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Major League Baseball's 86th annual All-Star Game Tuesday night, the American League defeated the National League 6-3 at Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati, Ohio. Joining us now with more details is VOA's Toddy Abeje. More sporty greetings, Toddy.
Sporty greetings to you, Sonny. It was more clout from Trout as Los Angeles Angels outfielder Mike Trout was named Most Valuable Player for the second consecutive year. Trout is the first player in Major League history to win back-to-back MVPs in the All-Star game. He started off the game by hitting a home run in the first inning. It was his only hit of the game. He also scored two runs to spice up his MVP performance. Hey, Mike, how does it feel to win back-to-back All-Star Game MVPs?
It feels awesome. I can't explain the feeling right now. Just the whole environment, whole experience. You know, it's been so fun. It's awesome.
Mike Trout's awesome performance also helped the American League gain home field advantage in October's World Series. The winning league in the All-Star Game gets that advantage. It means if the World Series goes the full seven games, the American League team will host four of the games. This will be the 14th World Series in which home field advantage was awarded to the league that won the All-Star Game. I'm VOA's Toddy Abeje. Back to you, Sonny.
Thank you, Toddy. Joining us now with an update on cycling's greatest event, the Tour de France, is VOA's Jonah Haskell. Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Sonny. The Tour de France continued Wednesday as riders passed the halfway point of the race, with Kenyan-born British rider Chris Froome still leading the pack. Stage 11 began in the historic town of Pau, nestled high in the Pyrenees Mountains of southern France, before continuing along a winding mountainous route through the scenic Pyrenees National Park, before finishing in the small town of Couteret in the picturesque Vallée de Saint-Savin. The largest climb of the day saw riders pedaling their way up the Col de Thumalay, which rises to 2,115 meters above sea level. The winner on the day was Rafal Majka of Russia, who rides for Tinkoff Saxo. Froome, who finished ninth on Wednesday, now leads the race by a total of 2 minutes and 52 seconds, earning him the coveted yellow jersey. And while he also leads the point standings in the climbers competition for the polka dot jersey, Froome cannot wear both. Chris's Team Sky teammate Richie Porte of Australia currently holds the polka dot jersey instead. MTN Kubeka, the only African team in the race, had a good stage, as MTN member Sergei Powells finished fourth. MTN Kubeka now sits in ninth place, just behind Swiss team IM Cycling, while Froome's British Team Sky takes the top spot. Stage 12 will take place Thursday, starting in the southern French town of Lannemezan, before finishing 195 kilometers away in the Plateau de Bella, just a few miles from the French borders with Andorra and Spain. With your Wednesday Tour de France update, I'm Jonah Haskell. Back to you, Sonny.
Thanks, Jonah, and thank you, Toddy Abeje. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to you, Hayes Woohee.
And thank you, Sonny, and thank you, Toddy Abeje and Jonah Haskell. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, experts say global joblessness will only get worse over the next 5 years. And next, war and suffering continues in South Sudan. But first, some music. Here is Job Verite of Burkina Faso with Picasso.
Becasso, 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 Becasso,
Sahara, mi fera bubu. Iye, bubu California. Quand tu vas à bubu, tu deviens tout hubu, tu deviens tout nouveau. Sababu yuma be bubu, bibi menya chamana mole charakila. Dunya magalu, person te kulenye. Ni se rabu bu, iye bubu California. Moya be bubu, sababu yuma be bubu. La moya be bubu, la hora bubu jula so, be kaso be bubu hanya so, mona dora to bubu jula so, la hora bubu. Big Martin for you, Tandy for you, Berthe for you, Sidonie for you, Emmanuel for you, Radio Balafon for you, Yakuli Palice for you, Kusube for you, Marukanazwe for you.
Jah Verite of Burkina Faso with Bekasso. The United Nations says roughly 200 million people around the world had no jobs in 2014, and a large number were women and youth. Experts say global joblessness will only get worse over the next 5 years. But a new report says there is good news for those in places like South Sudan who have access to the internet. Reporter Ian Bior explains.
The World Bank and its partners released a new report that says employment on the internet, also known as online outsourcing, can be an option for job seekers in the developing world. The report says the outsourcing industry will employ about 30 million people and will be worth $15 to $25 billion by 2020. That's music to the ears of university-age students at Unity State's Ajuang Thok refugee camp, who don't have running water or electricity, but they do have access to computers. Students like Kuwa Arinde take computer training classes at the camp. He says he sees his computer training as a chance to get out of the camp and make something of himself.
Most of us didn't know to use computer, but when we received this project, we have learned a lot. We have been connected to the world. We have opened Facebook, email, Skype, and also we have been using this project to also, for example, if you are a teacher, you can download the teaching material.
The Ajuang Thok camp is located in Paryang County. It is hundreds of miles from the capital, but that is not stopping some of its residents from thinking about taking courses at Juba University and eventually looking for work in the U.S. or China. But the idea of having to travel South Sudan's unpaved roads to attend Juba University has become a thing of the past for these students. Instead, they take ICT training or innovations of computer technology right at the refugee camp. Annette Kavin, program coordinator for Lutheran World Federation, a humanitarian agency that manages the schools in Ajuang Thok, says it's more than a refugee camp, it's a global village.
They have access to computer at the moment, and all the computers have been installed with internet. So at the moment, they can have access to information on what is taking place in the country and what is taking place in the globe right from within the refugee camp because of the access of the internet.
The recent World Bank report says communities like Ajuang Thok can use the internet to leverage more online employment opportunities. In a country like South Sudan, where the jobless rate is among the highest in the world, thousands of youth could gain a lot from online outsourcing. Cecilia Parati-Gilford, an ICT innovation specialist at the World Bank, says the report's researchers studied Kenya and other African countries in depth.
This will be the first publication to summarize and analyze global experiences in online outsourcing and provide a comprehensive analysis and a first toolkit for countries and the private sector to assess countries' competitiveness for online outsourcing.
But in South Sudan, where the illiteracy rate is as high as 73%, How will students learn about online jobs if they can't read? Again, Cecilia Prati-Guilford.
Learn literacy is a challenge. However, there are tasks that could be appropriate provided there is some training involved to help connect these workers to these platforms and also to be able to conduct these tasks.
The report says some of the advantages of online outsourcing is broader access to specialized skills, faster hiring, and global job opportunities, and a more flexible work environment. It also provides possibilities for people with all types of abilities. But at the same time, there are challenges with online outsourcing.
Some of these might also limit a number of them, for instance, like women to fully participate in ICT and getting that exposure to the outside world. So these are some of the few challenges that probably we are experiencing at the moment.
Kaveen says it will take time to take full advantage of all the internet has to offer. But she has no doubt that young people in developing countries like South Sudan will quickly reap the benefits of online outsourcing. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
As the conflict in South Sudan continues, the UN and the world seem unable to help the nation find a solution and bring relief to a growing displaced population. VOA's Vincent McCourty asks Justin Fleischman of the UNAV Project why the peace process is moving so slowly.
The peace process is moving in slow motion, but the conflict itself is actually accelerating. Right now, you're having a competition between government and opposition forces over the last remaining productive oil fields in Upper Nile. If those fields close, the income of the country essentially drops to zero, and it's already facing economic collapse.
Yeah. So there is on one side an economic collapse, which some are saying now is causing other issues like lack of food. But tell us about the humanitarian crisis, how this conflict has impacted the civilians of South Sudan.
Sure. The number of people facing severe food insecurity has almost doubled since the beginning of this year, from 2.5 million to almost 4.6 million. And that number is just going to continue to worsen as the conflict continues.
Mm-hmm. Now, why is it that it seems like the world is not paying attention to this? Mm-hmm. Is it true, or are we making a misguided observation here?
I think there is a lot of interest in South Sudan. It's a topic of conversation at the UN constantly. The US government is involved. But when it actually comes to action, that has been where the international community is failing the people of South Sudan. There's a UN Security Council resolution that provides for the possibility of specific targeted designations against individuals that would freeze their assets and their personal wealth, that would change their calculations whether or not to continue fighting. But because of the geopolitics, because of the complexity of the region, the US, Russia, China, other permanent members, and other African states that are directly involved in the peace process haven't taken those steps to really ensure that there's accountability and consequences for the parties continuing this conflict. And that's where
Talking about accountability, it looks like the two sides are really daring the world. We're getting all these reports about actually attacks on UN camps where civilians have gone to seek refuge.
Sure.
What do you make of that?
There's 120,000 civilians or so that are currently seeking protection directly on UN bases across the country. I think what we've seen is, as the conflict has continued, there have been no consequences for human rights violations, for mass atrocities, for killing civilians. And so the parties are becoming more bold and more brazen. And we're seeing both sides taking tactics that they learned in Khartoum, for instance, and applying them to their own civilian populations in South Sudan without consequence. Yeah.
You've been studying this issue for a long time. Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense that the leadership in South Sudan on both sides are really concerned about the humanitarian crisis in their own country?
I think they, you know, and when we speak to them directly, both sides feel that they have some moral high ground, that they are the ones that should lead the country, that they should govern.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, neither side is taking responsibility for actually what the impact is on the ground.
And besides even responsibility, are they doing anything, for example, to stop the suffering or at least to prevent the deaths of civilians?
Amnesty International just released a report on human rights violations in Bentiu and Unity State, and we're hearing some of the worst atrocities being committed recently. So obviously, whatever they say at the peace process is not making an impact in how their troops are behaving on the ground.
That was Justin Fleischman talking to VOA's Vincent McCorry about the worsening refugee crisis in South Sudan. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late June, the U.S. State Department issued its country reports on human rights practices, as it has done every year since 1977. The reports, which cover 199 countries and entities, strive to provide a comprehensive and factual review of human rights conditions and practices around the world. This year's report notes that although the focus is, as always, on the actions of governments, the year 2014 will be remembered for atrocities committed by non-state actors such as ISIL, Boko Haram, al-Shabaab, Jabhat al-Nusra, and regional incarnations of al-Qaeda against innocent civilians, as well as for the remarkable brutality of their actions. But inhumane treatment of civilians was not limited to extremist groups. The government of Syria and its affiliated militias used equally brutal tactics against their own people, including massacres, indiscriminate bombings, summary executions, rape, and forced displacement of non-combatants. Elsewhere, numerous states continued to use violence or repressive laws to silence domestic dissidents and aggressively crack down on freedom of expression, including through the use of new media. Governments blocked access to websites, and in some cases, human rights activists who used the internet were tried as criminals and punished as terrorists. The reports pointed out that there is a strong correlation between corruption, human rights abuses, and repressive governance. Again and again, 2014 saw unrestrained rulers use corruption to cement their overall grip on power. For 39 years, the Human Rights Country Reports have documented stories of abuse and rights denied. Over the years, they have expanded to include human trafficking, internet freedom, the rights of persons with disabilities, and the LGBTI community. The discomfort that these reports sometimes cause does more to reinforce than to undermine the value and credibility of these reports, said Secretary Kerry. Truth cannot successfully be evaded or dented or defeated. Not over time. It cannot be changed. The truth wins out. Leaders who are upset by these findings should look at how people are treated in their own countries. Every country, including the United States, has room to improve, said Mr. Kerry. The path to global respect always begins at home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.